From beliefs to actions. Ideologies, ideas and values, beliefs about other people and the world, prejudices and hatreds. These are the things, mechanisms, structures, call them what you will, that have moved the perpetrators of these and many other mass murders and eliminations. The people slaughtering, eliminating, and inflicting immense suffering on other people, upon millions of children, have been motivated by their beliefs about the victims and about the treatment or punishments they justly deserve. Mass murder begins not in abstract structures or inchoate psychological pressures, but in the minds and hearts of men and women. When leaders are ready for elimination and the kill, they activate people's otherwise inert eliminationist beliefs by announcing, themselves or through surrogates, publicly or only within eliminationist institutions, that the onslaught is necessary and about to begin. Depending on how much people have contemplated what to actually do to the targeted groups, different reactions greet the eliminationist announcement or notification. To those believing in the necessity of dealing somehow with the acute problem the victims putatively pose, yet who themselves have not dwelled on solutions, especially the most radical ones, learning of an eliminationist campaign comes as an epiphany or relief. Upon their leaders' or government's decision to expel or kill the despised and feared group, or upon witnessing the onslaught itself, many react with satisfaction and approval. They finally apprehend what was always within them about how they must proceed. Just as, in the words of the critic Roger Fry, an artist with a great artwork can teach people something new about themselves, so too can the leader who offers a new way of looking at and solving a commonly agreed-upon problem. We feel that he has expressed something which was latent in us all the time, but which we never realized, that he has revealed us to ourselves in revealing himself. A heady sense of righteousness and mission can also accompany this epiphany, which coalesces into a person's determination to contribute to the heroic enterprise. Kristallnacht, the proto-genocidal nationwide assault in 1938 upon Germany's Jews, their synagogues and communal institutions, their businesses and homes, initially shook Melita Moschmann, a teenager fully subscribing to the demonological image of Jews in Germany. Then belief's logic took hold. For a space of a second, I was clearly aware that something terrible had happened there, something frighteningly brutal. But almost at once I switched over to accepting what had happened as over and done with and avoiding critical reflection. I said to myself, the Jews are the enemies of the new Germany. Last night they had a taste of what this means. Let us hope that world Jewry, which has resolved to hinder Germany's new steps towards greatness, will take the events of last night as a warning. If the Jews sow hatred against us all over the world, they must learn that we have hostages for them in our hands. Another class of people is not surprised because they have had foresight or a self-articulated desire for a concrete eliminationist solution. Upon learning of the actual eliminationist program, they react more matter-of-factly, which does not mean without jubilation, but without experiencing an epiphany. For them, it's about time. Let's get on with it. Finally. A Hutu executioner, Pankras Hakizamungili, explains, the first day, a messenger from the municipal judge went house to house, summoning us to a meeting right away. There, the judge announced that the reason for the meeting was the killing of every Tutsi without exception. It was simply said, and it was simple to understand. Fulgence, a comrade, concurs. The judge told everyone that from then on we were to do nothing but kill Tutsi. Well, we understood. That was a final plan. The atmosphere had changed. Others, chomping at the bit, have been waiting to act upon long-standing wishes. When the enabling orders come, they can finally have a go at the enemies, giving the hated people what they deserve and more. Such reactions are found among the shock troops of murderous leaderships such as the SA and SS in Germany, the students of China's Cultural Revolution, the Khmer Rouge's cadres, Iraq's Republican Guards, the Serbs' Arkan Tigers, the Hutus' Interahamwe, and others. Like eager, impassioned soldiers primed for battle, these people understand that their leaders have been pointing them, sometimes explicitly, toward eliminating their enemies, want it to happen, and, when it does, finally let loose their pent-up hatred. Many such people are already in institutions that mobilize for killing. Others are among the larger pool of potential perpetrators, in other words, the general populace governed by eliminationist prejudices. That is why some popular assaults, sometimes called pogroms or riots, are initially so wild and frenzied. Often they are analyzed misleadingly as mob psychology or crowd behavior. If we see such assaults not as the mob's licentiousness somehow magically taking over people, but as a sudden activating, unleashing, and channeling of people's pre-existing, pent-up animosities and desires toward their targets, then we can understand such explosions and their frenzied quality. Mob or crowd psychology's cliched account is inapplicable to eliminationist assaults, or, if applicable, then at most to an insignificant part of them. People's prior beliefs and hatreds' activation and validation, their satisfaction of acting upon them, and their immediate social reinforcement from their collective participation in a common valued project characterize these initial popular responses to the announcement of exterminationist and eliminationist assaults. Mob psychology cannot be what is driving them to act, because in so many cases, the people continue after the initial spasm of violence to brutalize and kill the targeted group, or to support those who do. The person in the crowd thinks or says, "I did something I never imagined myself doing," but he does not say, "I suddenly had my views of the people I assaulted utterly and forever changed, and for the first time saw them to be so pernicious as to deserve what they got." Among those believing that the people targeted for elimination in principle deserve their fate are those nevertheless disapproving of a given punishment, particularly mass annihilation, because they deem it immoral. This attitude, belief in a person's guilt, belief in the need for severe punishment, but opposition to killing, characterizes in many societies people opposing the death penalty, even for criminals committing the most heinous acts. Thus, some people animated by great prejudice against a group balk at the most final eliminationist solutions. This moral inhibition may come from a person's individual moral sense, or be culturally derived from various sources, especially religion. Religious leaders sharing in their societies or groups' prejudices and hatreds often support eliminationist onslaughts, even lethal ones. But others resist acting upon their beliefs' logic because of the values informing their understanding of the human and divine order. Many Catholic clergy, while agreeing with Germans and many other Europeans regarding the Jews' supposed pernicious nature and guilt, and the need to eliminate them and their influence from European society, balked at mass murder. The Vatican's authoritative journal Civiltà Cattolica, in 1937, before the systematic mass murder began, explicitly expressed this when contemplating what ought to be done with the Jews. It was an obvious fact that the Jews are a disruptive element because of their dominating spirit and their revolutionary tendency. Judaism is a foreign body that irritates and provokes the reactions of the organism it has contaminated. The journal discussed solutions to the Jewish problem ambivalently and explicitly considered various forms of, in its own formulation, elimination as functional equivalents. Civiltà Cattolica thereby indicated that the different solutions were, in principle, compatible with its assessment of the Jews' evil and their supposed threat to Christian society. In addition to segregation, not categorized as elimination, it discussed undertaking the Jews' expulsion. The Vatican's authoritative journal also proposed a still more extreme solution to the putative problem of the Jews, which it called the clearly hostile manner of destruction. The need to eliminate the Jews was self-evident to and stated as a matter of course by the Catholic Church's leaders. After all, it was a long-standing doctrinal position and robust discourse grounded in it. The Church's prominent intellectual leaders publishing Civilta Cattolica articulated to its readership, the Church's leadership, almost matter-of-factly, that mass slaughter was in principle a logically thinkable solution to the Jewish problem as they conceived it, though in this article they rejected wholesale killing as unchristian. Not surprisingly, the Church's leadership across Europe welcomed eliminationist policies against the Jews short of mass murder, because such policies concorded with their eliminationist beliefs without violating their ethical views. Those explicitly approving in principle of a policy of mass annihilation or elimination's justness or deservedness might think it impractical or unwise, as von Schlieffen did regarding the Herero. He wrote to Chancellor Bernard von Bülow, "One can agree with von Trotha's plan of annihilating the whole people or driving them from the land. The intention of General von Trotha can therefore be approved. The only problem is that he does not have the power to carry it out." So von Schlieffen recommended to von Bülow, who viewed the annihilation as unchristian, economically injurious, and harmful to Germans' reputation among Europeans, that von Trotha's annihilation order be rescinded. Kaiser Wilhelm II, who himself had declared Christian principles invalid for dealing with heathens and savages, after weeks of foot-dragging, finally did so. The eliminationist means changed from total annihilation, but not in favor of expulsion. The Herero, according to von Schlieffen, would present a constant threat. Instead, they settled for another of those interchangeable eliminationist options, chaining and turning those surrendering into slaves, including by branding each one's body with a GH for Gefangen Herero, captured Herero. The Germans' formal halt of mass killing, because it was born of practicality, was only partial. They continued their annihilationist practices against the rebellious Nama, slaughtering an estimated 75% of them and depositing most of the rest in camps as forced laborers. Such initial disquietude with eliminationist assaults occurs mainly when the policies are new or newly publicized. Once mass extermination and elimination becomes a country's common practice and a political norm, such reactions likely further diminish, except perhaps among children upon becoming conscious of the destruction. Particularly in societies with working camp systems or with eliminationist assaults underway, as Rwanda or the former Yugoslavia, such initial reactions give way to the new common-sense political reality. Killing just is. It is, like other central features, part of these societies' taken-for-granted natural order. Because perpetrators typically believe they are performing a historic, difficult, and extraordinary, albeit radical, act by slaughtering, expelling, or incarcerating their people's enemies, and that they act in the name of their nation or ethnic or religious group, their need for approval from people of their society or group, the bystanders, is important for their sense of self-justification. The principal exception to this has been communist regimes' perpetrators, who conceive of their peoples as not mature enough to understand the communist future's necessity. Their educational dictatorships must force, often with violence, their people to build and join the communist promised land. But perpetrators not beholden to such a self-inoculating ideology are situated differently socially. If their own people actually condemned the eliminationist program, it would powerfully undercut their rationale for acting and their confidence in their view's rightness. Being seen as a mass murderer and heinous criminal by one's people and community is not an inviting prospect. Most exterminationist and eliminationist perpetrators know that this fate does not await them. It did not happen in Turkey, Japan, Germany, Burundi, or Rwanda, among Hutu, Serbia, and elsewhere. Our investigation of the perpetrators suggests that we must be similarly skeptical of received views and must ask the same kinds of probing questions about bystanders' critical role. Instead of closing down the investigation before it has begun, accepting the hollow cliché of bystanders' impotence, we must similarly ascertain the bystanders' stances to an eliminationist onslaught. The first and most critical issue is whether and how much bystanders identify with the perpetrators' actions. If bystanders support them, if they believe that the annihilation is just, good, and necessary, then even without further tangible aid, they already provide the social lubricant easing the wheels of slaughter by affirming to the perpetrators that they serve a necessary, even noble purpose and will be welcomed, perhaps feted upon returning to their communities. If bystanders support perpetrators' eliminationist goals, then questions about the putative or real coercion or terror that supposedly stops them from aiding victims are rendered moot, exposed as diversionary exculpatory discourses parallel to the ones for the perpetrators. A Hutu who hid 11 Tutsi, when asked if he knew of others who hid Tutsi, said no. When further asked why others had not been like him, he did not intone the exculpatory clichés about coercion or fear or peer pressure. Instead, this former policeman knowingly replied, "People don't have the same mind." They did not apprehend the Tutsi extermination as he did. Only when bystanders actually condemn, as this exceptional Hutu did, the ongoing mass annihilation, expulsion, or incarceration, do questions become relevant about the opportunities and risks of acting on the victim's behalf. Most bystanders during many eliminationist onslaughts so evidently identify intensely with the perpetrators that the victims and others hold them responsible or guilty together with the actual perpetrators. After all, people watching their countrymen corral, brutalize, and slaughter or drive from their homes other people whom they despise often demonstrate their approval, even by jeering or lording it over the victims, that is, when not taking initiative to lend a hand themselves. The victim's accumulated experience of the bystander's general identification with the perpetrator's eliminationist projects was true for Armenians of Turks, for Jews of Germans and Poles, Lithuanians, and others, for other victim peoples, Poles, Czechs, French, Dutch, and others, of the German occupiers and ethnic Germans among them, for Bosnian Muslims of Serbs, and for Tutsi of Hutu, that it became a kind of common sense for these and other mass murders and eliminations. A similar such identification of bystanders with perpetrators is absent among many communist regimes' victims, because these victims knew that large portions of their societies were the regime's targets or potential targets. When victims closely identify bystanders with perpetrators, they regularly make the accusation of collective guilt, meaning that the perpetrator's nation, people, or group are criminally guilty. This charge has a powerful experiential foundation in the overwhelming support the victims see the broader populace giving to the eliminationist enterprise, so that those opposing it appear to be rare exceptions. The gross error of the collective guilt charge is typically not in its experiential basis, but, as I argue in Hitler's Willing Executioners and then at great length in A Moral Reckoning, in the victim's conceptual elaboration of that experience. Victims and other contemporaries know that bystanding compatriots or ethnic or racial clansmen by and large support the mass murders and eliminations. That is correct. But moving from this fact to charge collective guilt is based upon some combination of three errors: that all members of the perpetrator's group are implicated, instead of only those, perhaps very many, who committed actual transgressions; are implicated merely owing to their membership in that group, instead of each person's individual acts; and are legally implicated in the eliminationist acts themselves and therefore guilty, instead of being only morally blameworthy for the eliminationist acts they themselves did not commit, but merely supported, which is a different culpability from legal guilt. People can be deemed guilty only as individuals for their individual acts. Guilt cannot be inherited by subsequent generations, and guilty in a legal sense only when those acts are crimes. It has been the case, certainly, that many Turkish, German, Serbian, and Hutu perpetrators were collectively guilty in that as perpetrators they brutalized, expelled, and murdered in concert. But this is different from saying all Turks, Germans, Serbs, or Hutu are guilty because they are members of peoples that broadly supported the perpetrators of eliminations. Individual Turks, Germans, Serbs, and Hutu should be held legally culpable for their individual criminal deeds, which can include membership in criminal organizations, but deemed morally blameworthy for their individual moral positions. To be sure, some bystanders, like some perpetrators, materially benefit from their neighbor's destruction or expulsion. People who hate other people and see them as a mortal danger are often happy to improve their own material or professional lives when their self-conceived enemies are eliminated. Yet there is little evidence that personal benefit has been a widespread or determinative motive leading bystanders to support mass murder and elimination, or that absent such material benefits, they would oppose them. If such an acquisitive motive were operative, it would mean that these same bystanders would approve of the extermination or expulsion of any group, any neighbors, including men, women, and children, merely to gain a few material possessions. A position that is, on its face, untenable, just as it is about the perpetrator's willingness to commit their deeds. In all mass murders, expulsions, and incarcerations, only a certain, often small percentage of the people stand to enrich themselves. Support for the perpetrators appears to be equally widespread among bystanders who gain nothing and those who benefit materially. Because the perpetrators are their peoples, or large portions of their peoples, representatives, in that they share a common conception and hatred of the victims, and common goals. While the perpetrators implement the leader's will and the bystanders support the deeds out of conviction, they, as we see, develop their varying views about the deed's justice and desirability in different ways. Perpetrators also react differently, as do bystanders, when learning of the eliminationist campaigns that are consonant with the logic of their prejudices and hatreds. Whether because of the general disregard for the lives of non-communal members, because of hatreds forged in the heat of conflict, because of ideologically derived eliminationist visions, or because of long-standing eliminationist bigotry that is activated, the perpetrators and, as a rule, bystanders from among their own group, come in some way to approve of the deed. Whether surprised, relieved, or enthused when learning of the intended acts, the bearers of eliminationist sentiments' various reactions are nevertheless predicated upon their shared approval for those acts. Differences in how the approval is generated help us understand the eliminationist assaults, but only in part. The actual beliefs, as distinct from the mechanisms producing them, need also to be analyzed, because they vary significantly, and their variations are critically important for explaining why the perpetrators in different eliminationist onslaughts conduct themselves differently. These many themes are taken up in Part 3. From this discussion, several conclusions follow. The Holocaust was singular in certain dimensions, as are other eliminationist assaults, but not in the general congruence of leaders' and perpetrators' beliefs or in its perpetrators' moral approval. Both are common, constituent features of mass murder and elimination. Hence, the relationship between leaders and followers needs to be rethought no less than other faulty received notions about bureaucracies, authority, etc., that have been put forward without regard and in firm contradiction to what we know about politics and social life. For mass murders, the relationship between leaders and perpetrators is usually analyzed as one of psychological dependence, authority, or compulsion. The leaders are usually presented as all-powerful agents, and the followers as people with no or little capacity to adopt their own positions, and then to have those positions matter by affecting their own conduct, influencing leaders' estimations of what is possible or desirable, or having an effect in any way over what happens. But this is, of course, not at all how politics works, or how we in every sphere of politics except eliminationist politics, which is commonly reduced to the mind-numbing word genocide, think of the relationship between leaders and followers, whether the politics are democratic or non-democratic. In no other area of politics do we assume or assert as a matter of faith that followers do not reflect upon the rightness of their leaders' politics and policies, reflexively accept or follow their leaders' wishes, or are passive vessels to be infused with and moved by whatever leaders want. Dissent from, suspicion of, and resistance to political leaders' wishes, programs, and policies is the norm throughout the world under all kinds of regimes, including during war in general, and particularly when people disagree with those policies, especially when those policies violate people's deepest moral values, as a policy to slaughter other human beings, to slaughter children, would, if indeed people thought it wrong. What is missing from the theorized and non-theoretical discussion of eliminationist politics is commonplace in the understanding and theorizing of other kinds of politics, the fundamental recognition of people's agency and of the complex relationship that that agency necessarily creates between them and their leaders, and between them, the circumstances of their actions, and what they actually do. Working through these relationships, both theoretically and in concrete cases, necessitates, among others, two things. First, a reintegration of the cognitive and moral dimensions of the followers' stances toward their leaders in general and, at least as critically, toward particular policies, initiatives, and goals that their leaders adopt or seek to pursue. Followers' views about people designated as targets and their understanding of acceptable and appropriate moral action are critical for how they will respond psychologically, how they will perceive the legitimacy of authority, including so-called charismatic authority, and whether compulsion would be necessary, might be tried, or would succeed. Second, we need to recognize that the eliminationist situation is inherently fluid, with leaders calling on pre-existing beliefs, helping sometimes to intensify and further shape them, or to overcome lingering moral inhibitions, able to do so often only under the prior constraints those existing beliefs and values create. Our analysis of this complex and fluid relationship and the conduct that emerges from it must necessarily also be fluid. It is true that predispositions among followers to eliminate potential target groups must often be cultivated and must all but invariably be called upon by leaders if the followers are not to remain relatively quiescent. It is also the case that, absent some catastrophic assault upon a people, leaders cannot, certainly not in a few weeks or even a few years, create a large, willing, let alone eager followership for vast exterminationist and eliminationist policies, for children's mass annihilation, if those followers do not already accept the fundamentals of the leader's worldview about the victims and about the aspects of society and politics relevant for determining what ought to be done with the victims. Leaders can get followers to go willingly only where the followers are already, in some sense, prepared to go. This was true for Mehmet, Talat, and Turks, for Hitler and Germans during the Nazi period, for Slobodan Milosevic and Serbs, and for the Hutu leaders and Hutu. It has been true across our time's exterminationist and eliminationist assaults. We must jettison the rigid, typically dichotomous thinking that, in three related respects, characterize discussion of mass murder, and eliminations more broadly, though eliminations are left out of such discussions. First, and touched on earlier, mass murder's interpreters attribute agency and efficacy to leaders or to followers, but not to both, and certainly fail to treat both as capable agents acting in a fluid relationship of mutual influence as movement occurs toward eliminationist measures. This dichotomous thinking has been almost uniform among writers about the Holocaust, as well as in the faulty paradigmatic thinking about perpetrators its interpreters have generated. Second, the sometimes explicit, though mainly implicit, model that dominates discussions about mass murder maintains, dichotomously, that perpetrators must have always wanted to kill the victims, or, if not, then prior beliefs about the victims must be irrelevant, and the perpetrators must have undergone a coercive transformation, not necessarily in belief, but in conduct, either through brainwashing, blind obedience, or some kind of psychological or threatening pressure. The strange reasoning underlying this position is that if the perpetrators, or more broadly, a people, had had exterminationist-compatible beliefs, then they would have annihilated them long before they finally did. Or, in the rhetorical question that is so often used to make this point, then why didn't it happen earlier? Because the perpetrators did not kill earlier, then the exterminationist beliefs, so the thinking continues, could not have been there. And therefore, when the perpetrators do actually kill, they cannot be willing killers in any meaningful sense of willing. The flip side of this mode of thinking, common to society-centered explanations of eliminationist assault's initiation, is that if murderous beliefs were always present, the leadership is but the conveyor belt of popular sentiment and intentions. If instead we understand, first, that prior beliefs predisposing people to adopt an eliminationist solution can exist while lying dormant, or that such beliefs might not have yet coalesced around a particular solution, or that their bearers might need a moral example and push, and second, that leaders activate, shape, intellectually, with policy and organizationally, and sanction dormant beliefs and moral views, then we can understand the complex of beliefs, policy, and actions at the heart of the process that leads from initiation to implementation. The third misleading rigid manner of thinking, which is implicated in the second, holds that beliefs and action have a one-to-one relationship. Beliefs about despised people and the actions desired by their bearers are treated by commentators as so intertwined that they are collapsed into each other, as if they are the same thing. This means that if someone supported or implemented one eliminationist solution, say forced emigration, then, so goes the faulty conclusion, he must have opposed more radical eliminationist solutions, such as annihilation. But as we know, eliminationist beliefs are compatible with various policy solutions, including various eliminationist ones. Belief's multiple potential for action is obvious in our own social experience and in politics. When thinking about people's or politicians' stances, say, toward crime, no one adopts the stilted, unrealistic paradigm that characterizes mass murders discussions. People can be willing to accept a wide range of laws and punishments as good or as merely adequate if the alternative is to do nothing. It is astonishing that the same flexible relationship between people's beliefs and the range of policies they would willingly support is explicitly or implicitly denied for the political issues of how people might treat despised and feared groups. Why and how different eliminationist solutions and mixes are decided upon in one instance and not another, and then, in any given instance, different ones during the evolution of policy, must be explored. Recognizing the critical quality of ordinary people's beliefs and values is the first important step. Recognizing the complexity of the relationship between beliefs and desired action is another. Refashioning our understanding of the relationships of beliefs and values and desired actions to other factors, which are also complex and changing, is necessary and predicated upon adopting a more fluid view of each component and its relationships to the others. As most people know from their own experience, we sometimes begin to look at a thing in certain ways only when relevant courses of action become possible. Newfound options can induce us to focus on an old matter with new intensity, from new angles, and with new reasoning. Suddenly, our previous thinking about the matter appears inadequate. A new solution is necessary, a newly offered one desirable. None of this is inevitable. At other times, when new courses of action present themselves, sometimes nothing changes. And sometimes, new options, socially or politically, have the opposite effect. As people realize the conduct that logically follows on their views is unpalatable, they might conclude that the views themselves are mistaken and need revision. This occurred for many deeply anti-Semitic Christian churches after the Holocaust, as their leaders and members came to see the perniciousness, indeed, in their terminology, the evil of anti-Semitic beliefs that had wrought such human destruction. However, if new ways of acting are compatible with our established views, we so often see the desirability of adopting them. This has been at the heart of eliminationist and exterminationist policies. The relationships among people's beliefs, the solutions they are willing to consider to perceived problems, and the actions they deem appropriate are complicated and fluid. The issue is not, as so many postulate, that eliminationist beliefs are suddenly created out of nowhere by structures, orders, or pressures. Rather, as Fulgence so pithily captured it when he explained that the atmosphere had changed, newly emerging favorable circumstances provide contexts for existing eliminationist beliefs to be massaged, channeled, and activated in varying forms and directions, resulting in the bearer's willingness to act, even to kill. While this can happen in several ways that have been discussed here, we need to appreciate the frequent component of epiphany. The sudden realization that unimagined or unexpected actual possibilities exist, that novel solutions could improve one's life or the lives of one's loved ones or community, can galvanize people in unexpected ways and even, precisely because of the sense of newness and good fortune, produce the euphoric zeal so often seen among the perpetrators. Such instances are human history's commonplaces. One occurred in 1989 when Romanian dictator President Nicolae Ceaușescu's mass rally went awry with millions of Romanians watching on television. The young people started to boo. They jeered the president, who still appeared unaware that trouble was mounting, rattled along denouncing anti-communist forces. The booing grew louder and was briefly heard by the television audience before technicians took over and voiced over a soundtrack of canned applause. It was a moment that made Romanians realize that their all-powerful leader was, in fact, vulnerable. It unleashed an afternoon of demonstrations in the capital and a second night of bloodshed. These youths did not trick or transform their countrymen, but unleashed the repressed passions and mobilized the latent beliefs among Romanians that would eventually bring down a so-called charismatic leader. And so, the people acted. Similarly, it is not political leaders' alleged charisma that magically dupes thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of people to support eliminationist ideals and programs that would otherwise violate their deepest beliefs and values. Aside from the simple fact that even the most supposedly charismatic leaders, including the allegedly most charismatic of all, Hitler, regularly meet resistance when they move against such cherished beliefs and values, no such so-called charismatic leaders exist in many mass murders and eliminations. Sometimes the leader's identity or character is barely known. So-called charismatic leadership was absent in German Southwest Africa, in Turkey, in British Kenya, in Indonesia, in many Latin American countries, in Burundi, in Rwanda, and in so many other eliminations. When leaders, whether putatively charismatic or not, offer people a heretofore unimagined or seemingly implausible opportunity to act violently and lethally that accords with, in fact fulfills, their deepest existing values and beliefs, people suddenly realize they can solve a previously unsolvable, though grave, problem. The Hutu mass murderer Pancras explains along these lines how we should understand the critical mobilizing place of the president's death and a fear of falling under the rule of the Inkotanyi, cockroaches, in the Hutu's complex of prior dormant beliefs and subsequent impassioned action. The Hutu always suspects that some plans are cooking deep in the Tutsi character, nourished in secret since the passing of the ancient regime. He sees a threat lurking in even the feeblest or kindest Tutsi. But it is suspicion, not hatred. The hatred came over us suddenly after our president's plane crashed. The intimidators shouted, "Just look at these cockroaches! We told you so!" And we yelled, "Right! Let's go hunting." We weren't that angry. More than anything else, we were relieved. We should accept the fluidity, which does not mean total malleability, of this complex of beliefs, solutions, opportunity, calls to action, and conduct, because it accounts best for the facts. It helps us make sense of the indeterminacy of beliefs and values while according them their essential place in the eliminationist equation. It allows us to explore the complicated relationship between eliminationist beliefs and eliminationist action in Part 3, which is at once the core of the eliminationist stance and deed, and very hard to know. When, as the perpetrators almost always have, people believe that other groups, other people, are of a character that makes eliminating them, including with lethal violence, right and necessary, then, once unleashed, these people become the most self-motivated, zealous, and effective implementers of political policy the world has known. Hence the paradox that confounds so many. Without political leadership, the overwhelming majority of the perpetrators would not lift a finger in harm, but once set in motion, typically but with a few encouraging and enabling words, they, both the eliminationist regime's shock troops and their society's ordinary members, be they ordinary Turks, ordinary Germans, ordinary Indonesians, ordinary Tutsi, ordinary Serbs, or ordinary Hutu, give themselves body and soul to death. They do so easily, effortlessly, and to them, logically. I think the possibility of genocide fell out as it did because it was lying in wait for time's signal, like the plane crash, to nudge it at the last moment, explains the Hutu perpetrator Ignace Rukiramakumu. There was never any need to talk about it among ourselves. The thoughtfulness of the authorities ripened it naturally, and then it was proposed to us. As it was their only proposal, and it promised to be final, we seized the opportunity. We knew full well what had to be done, and we set to doing it without flinching, because it seemed like the perfect solution.